Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon. And today we're talking to someone who knows all the secrets of longevity. It is Dr. Stephen Murphy. Stephen stands at the forefront of personalized healthcare and longevity, and he blends traditional medical wisdom with his innovative genetic, regenerative, cellular, and orthobiologic teachings and his energy-based approach. He said it himself that this year is the year of the mitochondria, and I think it's true. He's a board-certified specialist in internal medicine and obesity medicine. He's an author, professor, and executive, and his expertise is totally enriched by his training in clinical genetics from Yale and Mount Sinai. And he's practiced nearly 15 years. He has a really diverse clientele of elites, from royalty to executives to top-tier professional athletes and individuals who want to live longer and experience a life well lived. So welcome to the podcast, Stephen.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is going to be great.
It's going to be great. So for listeners meeting you for the first time, how would you describe the work that you do and how did it cross over into longevity medicine?
Oh, wow. It's very funny because I think I've always been a longevity doctor, right? Who doesn't want to help their patients live longer, live healthier? Who doesn't want to detect disease before it happens? And I think my training in genetics had me look for risks for disease before disease happened. And it just so happens in caring for patients with genetic disease, it turns out at the extremes is where we find common problems with aging. And so when you add that to my interest in obesity medicine, we could see a population that was rapidly aging. And so our tools, I kind of stumbled into it. So it really wasn't until 2013 when they published the Blueprint of Aging that I began to realize that I was actually doing longevity medicine.
The hallmarks of aging, you mean?
You got it. Exactly.
And you have said this year that the mitochondria is the leading target in the aging process. So of all the hallmarks, do you really focus down on treating that dysfunction in your patients?
I think when you go root cause, a lot of the problems we have result from mitochondrial dysfunction, that's for sure.
For sure. When you say that every person is unique, as unique as their own genetic code, what does that mean in real clinical practice? Are you doing really deep baseline testing and assessments of each person before you even dive into their health, motivation and how to fix them going forward?
Oh yeah, I think that getting a family history and getting a genomic evaluation really help add understanding the blueprint. But remember, it's not just your own genes, it's also the mitochondrial genes. Not all of us have the same haplotype of mitochondria, and that really plays a role here too, for sure.
It definitely does. Where do you think that traditional medicine gets it right, and where does it fall short for patients who want optimal health? So many Americans are still in traditional American healthcare, and they hear all this longevity talk. How do they get it?
Well, I think pharma is really good at making potent things, right? Really strong, potent things that treat disease. The problem is disease has already caused damage. If you look at like diabetes and insulin resistance existed probably 12 years before you had the disease. The goal here is to be able to detect when that problem happens. And so I think in the longevity field, if we can get diagnostics quicker and get a baseline blueprint of your resiliency, you can do a lot to heal here before you ever have disease.
Are there some tests that you think that we should all be starting with besides, I call it the do not die, like you're not going to die this year with your CBC and your chemistry and your liver function. You get a pass fail from your doctor, like you passed your physical, but what is there beyond the do not die labs?
You know, I love that term, the do not die labs, because what I traditionally say is you can buy the green bananas. It means that the bananas will be along just as long as you are, right? So if you're going to live 7 days, your bananas will ripen if you buy the green ones. And so there are many more labs to do than just the green bananas checklist. I think the most important thing to understand about us is that we're energetic beings and we need to produce energy. But we also need to transform energy. So I think about the food that we take in and how we metabolize it. And so the way I look at that, I look at downstream things like inflammatory markers, high sensitivity CRP. I also look at your immune system. A lot of people do not realize that after this pandemic that we had, whatever you want to think about it, people ended up with more inflammation. People ended up with dysregulated immune systems. And that plays a huge role in our skin, in our heart, in our brain. And so if you're not checking that immune system, you're missing out on a key panel here looking at that. And that involves T cells, B cells, NK cells, and their signaling molecules like cytokines. So a lot of people miss out on that. And so I think that's important. And then hormones, hormones, hormones. I can't emphasize enough how important it is to manage hormones for your health.
Yeah, and when you say T cells, B cells, natural killer cells, more than just what you find on a CBC with the differential, or
Oh, for
that
sure,
makes
right? The down and dirty here is like the monocyte to leukocyte, or sorry, monocyte to lymphocyte ratio, but that pales in comparison to getting a good look at your T cells, your B cells, your NK cells, and your naive T cells, because naive T cells help us look at your thymus. So the thymus is probably one of the most important longevity organs, not just for our inner organs, but also our outer organs. And the thymus controls your T cells, which ultimately control inflammation and autoimmune disease, which plagues a lot of us in a lot of different places. So being able to identify your health of your thymus is going to be essential, not just for longevity on the inside, but also on the outside.
Interesting. And are you prescribing peptides right now, which are all the rage? And so
So,
many of us are wanting to use peptides, don't know how to start. And what are your thoughts?
all right. So I'll go on the record to say this. I've been invited to speak in a lot of different areas, right? I've traveled the globe speaking about peptides. And I've been involved in helping people use peptides for well north of a decade, maybe even 15 years now, little under. And here's what I've found. There are some peptides, when properly sourced, that really help people heal. The evidence that we have for them is really what we call anecdata. And because of that, there is a big push against using peptides in traditional academic communities. But at the same time, they, on the other side, are sheepishly studying these same peptides. And so when I think about peptides and peptide use in patients, for either our orthobiologics or even our aesthetics. So we use peptides in these patients. And so we have to be serious about what we mean by peptides because there are lots of different peptides. And our goal is to use ones that will give a benefit and minimize risk of adverse events. So that's kind of my take.
What are some of the peptides that you rely on in your armamentarium that you think are time tested and worthy?
Right. So it's a very great question. The evidence behind some that are time tested is pretty weak, right? So you'll look at things like BPC 157 orally. That's a supplement, but that has been time tested in tons of animal studies and used anecdotally for humans for a very long time. I mean, this was isolated a very long time ago. And in fact, there's a whole joke about Pavlov's dog and the isolation of these body protection compound from gastric juices back then. So there's a lot of data behind it in terms of animals. In terms of humans, it's a lot softer. And so my take, my humble opinion here is using a peptide like that orally is pretty low risk. Injectable, we all know the issues going on with the FDA in that right now. GHK copper is another one where it's used in creams, and there's even people, even though the FDA doesn't allow it per se, that have used it injectable. Now, if you don't have, and this is an important thing, GHK copper, right? So GHK, three amino acids plus copper. So if it has copper, well, then it needs to be blue. And so most people are using GHK without the copper. And so I think that's very important that you understand that if you're going to use GHK copper, it's going to be blue, has to have copper in it. Another peptide that I like to use in this sort of situation that I think about is controlling autoimmunity. So in autoimmune disease, we see a lot of problems skin-wise. We see a lot of problems musculoskeletally. And so if we can control that using things like thymus and alpha-1, which works pretty well to help with your T cells and do some signaling, I find those are pretty effective. There's a whole lot more I could ramble on about, but really, those are three big ones that we find some benefit in. There are a whole bunch more mitochondrially, but we can talk about that later.
I think those mitochondrial peptides are exciting. Like one got FDA approved this year for Barth syndrome, which is a very rare disease, but I know people are already starting to use that. Can you talk a little bit about the SS31?
Sure. So SS31, also called forzitinate, is a cardiolipin stabilizer. So, in order to understand what cardiolipin is, you got to understand what the mitochondria is. And so, the mitochondria is kind of this dual folded layer organ in our body, which actually behaves more like a bacteria than it does like another organelle in our body. And so, the layers of the mitochondria, that kind of mitochondrial sandwich, run and transport electrons. The closer that the membranes are together, the faster the electrons move. As the electrons move faster, we generate more ATP. What's ATP? We'd like to call it energy, but it's really more like a money currency. So if you make more money, you can spend more money. And if you're more efficient at making money, like my friends in finance, then you make more money. And let me tell you, they spend the money. And it is that theory that using SS31 will make you more efficient at making money without leaving you with bags under your eyes or sleep deprived or any of those other things. And so that's really SS31 in a nutshell. It's used as an injectable. So people have to get used to the fact that they're going to need to inject themselves to use it.
Right. What do you think that is the most common pattern you're seeing in your high functioning patients? They do all the right things, they're exercising, they're eating right, but they still feel tired, inflamed, or overweight, or just metabolically stuck.
Yeah, so these are what we call wired but tired patients.
That's
That's what I call them.
right.
They're stressed, they're anxious, they're high performers, they get their sleep, but they're still tired. Often in these patients, we're seeing issues with neurotransmitters, we're seeing energy problems. Excuse me, we're seeing energy problems with their mitochondria, we're seeing gut dysbiosis, and we're seeing some sort of environmental triggers. These are the real big hallmarks here. And if you boil it all down to investigating their mitochondria, their inflammation levels, and their gut microbiome, you can solve a lot of the problems.
And maybe even their nervous system or their autonomic kind of.
Well, remember that the gut brain axis is very strong, and our production of short chain fatty acids really influences our ability to make neurotransmitters properly. And so rather than just give you like an SSRI, if you think about how you're producing serotonin and dopamine relative to your gut and how you're holding it in your platelets, then you'll see that it's more than just a brain disease. It's actually a you disease. And so if you can, again, I tell people 9 times out of 10, don't go on a bunch more medications for neurotransmitters. Make sure you're making the neurotransmitters right. And that comes down a lot to gut health.
And what would that start with, like getting on better DHA or getting some of the bacteria that produces oxytocin in the gut,
Right.
the
So,
Lactobacillus reuteri, right? Is that the one
yeah,
with
you got it. That's
it?
correct. The first step is taking inventory. So, one of the ways I like to take inventory is I like to look at your gut microbiome. There are a lot of ways to look at this. There's this thing called shotgun sequencing, and then there are different select genes that people will test for different microbiome analyses. I use, and again, I'm not getting paid to say this on your podcast or anything like that, but I use Vibrant. I will use Jonah. Those are my two main leads. Sometimes I will use the Genova or Doctor's Data testing, but I find Jonah and Vibrant to be more robust in identifying the inventory the bacteria have. But it's not just bacteria. It's also looking at the leakiness or the integrity of your gut. And so I like looking at zonulin, calprotectin, and a lot of these other protein markers we can find in your stool to identify whether you're inflamed or not. So I like to look at all of that kind of systemically.
And then are there dietary modifications you're putting everybody on? Is it like a lot of, roughage and fiber and
Right.
prebiotic
Yeah.
change?
So I know, and we're going to get to mitochondria here because with the gut bacteria talk to our mitochondria, right? And so different foods and different materials we eat will change how our bacteria produce these different molecules. And so thinking about it in a diet way, you have to dial that in. And so one of the things I find that is very hard for people is gluten. I also find that fermented vegetables, which are fantastic when you're building a good, healthy microbiome, kefir and kombucha and even like sauerkraut or kimchi. If your gut is leaky and you take those foods in, you will be very sick. So trying to change a diet without assessing the barrier of the gut first often leads to problems.
So I think that a lot of inflammatory bowel disease leads to skin manifestations too. We'll see it when people walk into the office that they have bright red irritation, rosacea, acne. Are you diagnosing people with that? Like,
Oh, we see it all the time. And
see.
the key, rather than, and I think this is true for skin health as a whole. The future of skin health is not going to be just here's another fancy cream. It's actually going to be let's look at your inside, let's investigate it, and let's heal it, right? That's really, I think, what you have to look for first, more than anything else.
I agree. And then for patients who have a doctor who's not really amenable to this, are there, places where they can get testing?
For sure. There are a ton of different places all out there who either are longevity medicine doctors that do functional medicine work. There are functional medicine and naturopathic doctors. The problem is separating the wheat from the chaff, right, Dr. K? You have to be able to know who's good or who's not. And I'm going to sheepishly tell you that I have a lot of patients who come to me from ChatGPT. Right. It sounds crazy, but someone will say, who's a good doctor? Let me ask AI. And not to blow my own horn, I'm kind of okay. But traditionally, a lot of these patients have been able to find excellent doctors using AI as a sieve for finding right people. Otherwise, I think you just have to be in a good group, have a good doctor that you work with to give you these sorts of referrals. And so that's very important. Another place I find is actually, believe it or not, Reddit. Reddit actually gives people a lot of opportunity to vet and evaluate providers. So those are two kind of crazy places that actually have good results.
That's kind of true. I've been seeing people off of ChatGPT also. And the weird thing is, they'll come with the whole, like, this is what chat says you should do to my patient.
Yes,
And,
right.
like, these are the labs I need.
What do you think about that, Dr. K? Do you
It's
think that that's
pretty
like,
annoying, I
yeah,
think.
right? It can be a challenge, right? Because now what they've created is an hour-long consultation without maybe recognizing that there's a cost to that hour-long consultation.
Well, I think it minimizes our expertise, and it implies that the computer's the fact basis, the factual logic of,
Right.
is
It's
not
wrong
as
a
good as
lot,
our
right? It's
experience.
wrong a lot. We now have some data that some of these specialized databases are actually maybe worse than the general ones, right? So
Yeah.
yeah.
Very true. And then also, like, there's artistry involved in any what I do anyhow.
Oh,
And
for sure.
I feel
You
like
half of your work, if not more, is your technical artistry.
it's very true. In our field, we are doing a lot of regenerative medicine in terms of changing how the skin heals itself. What do you think people should do to separate evidence-based longevity care from kind of, loopy wellness care? Because it's everywhere now. It's
Yeah.
literally in every mini mart, there's a wellness setup.
It's in Walmarts now.
Yeah.
I kid you not. Okay. And so, first off, that's you're probably red flag number one, right? If you're going to Walmart or McDonald's for your longevity, you have a challenge. I think what's important in trying to find longevity is trying to find not just someone who knows about the field or who heard about the field. It's someone who has a robust knowledge, because when you start to get out on the bleeding edge here, you want someone who has considered the risks and the benefits, someone who has the scientific understanding to recognize the limitations of the treatments, not someone who's going to be putting up a sandwich board that says, Ozempic, who? Come try retatrutide, right? Like, no, you don't want that. Even though it may look cool, and even though your friends from like Orange Theory have done it, you have to be very mindful of your own body. And there are a lot of things out there that are big risk. And so if you're taking that risk without the biologic basis to need that risky sort of treatment, why are you doing it? And so if you don't know your baseline risk, you sh it's very hard to even get involved in longevity without those challenges, right? So that's I think that's what it is. There are lots of groups, right? Like our longevity docs group is fantastic. And there's even an education course through it, which I think is unbelievable. I teach on the FDA in that course, so there's my shameless plug. But I think finding a good longevity doctor requires some due diligence. It requires asking other doctors. It requires investigating to see if they teach, maybe. Professorships tend to help, to see if maybe they have a certification. Some of these people have got good certification through several peptide organizations. Another thing I think is important is to make sure that in their general field that they're staying up to speed and up to base. And there's a lot of different ways to get board certification in the medical side rather than the surgical side, right? There's the NBPAS versus the ABMS. So you want to make sure that they're staying up to date. And that's really a good general rule for almost all doctors, not just longevity.
Are there some longevity trends that you think are dangerous or need more evaluation?
Oh, yes,
I
right.
see people doing some crazy things.
Right. So I want to, the field of parabiosis, which is like taking young blood from someone else, it seems kind of unheard of, right? Isn't that like what vampires are? So theoretically. So that is risky. Parabiosis right now is not ready for prime time. And that is literally taking young blood and infusing it in yourself. It's not ready for prime time. I think that's a risky one. Another field where I think is getting out over its ski tips, and there are very few people that are good, like Dr. Hazen down in the San Diego area with ProGenobiome is pretty reasonable. But fecal transplants without effectively knowing how to do it or getting it right, huge longevity risk, right? Some people say, well, I want a bunch of Akkermansia in my colon. Well, if you're not getting safe fecal transplants, you could get all sorts of risks there. So I think that's number two, that's a big risk. Number three, that may be out a little bit over at ski tips, is hyperbaric oxygen. Hyperbaric oxygen is fantastic when you have properly certified people with properly certified machines that are being properly monitored and evaluated. We just had two cases of people dying in hyperbaric chambers last year, one in Detroit, another one in Arizona. The Arizona one is especially unfortunate because he was actually treating himself. So he got in a chamber himself. In Detroit, it was tragic because it was a child. And the thought is they brought something into the chamber that created a spark. What you need to know about hyperbaric oxygen, you're literally creating a fuel air bomb. You're pressurizing oxygen. All it takes is a spark, and the chamber could catch fire or even explode.
That's intense. I even don't like the idea of plasmapheresis very much personally. And I think even show like running your entire bloodstream through all this plastic tubing. And here we are worried about microplastics. And what are you doing to your bloodstream?
Well, there's no doubt about that. If you're not doing it properly, plasmapheresis can be a big risk. And let's face it, there are a lot of places that are driven by profit motive, especially if they don't have a medical license at risk. And you know as well as I do, there are a lot of people who are using a medical in name only shield for a lot of their clinics that are not having proper monitoring of supplies. And that's a huge risk.
Yeah, and the cases last year too of people getting sick after taking peptide shots at a very reputable meeting and seemingly a good vendor. And I think that not everybody does their due diligence, and even cases where IV infusions have killed people.
Oh, for sure, absolutely. And that is very important. And this is why you need to understand everything that we do carries risk. And because of that, you want a licensed professional to think about those risks and mitigate those risks, not say, hey, we're doing risks and mimosas at 10 a.m., right? No, right? You want to be able to evaluate the risk. And so you need a good Sherpa. You need a good practitioner that's going to be able to help you there rather than, phone a friend.
Exactly. I think one other question I got for you is how should patients look at their longevity and prevention differently at each decade, like in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s? Are there some landmark things to be doing in each decade?
Oh, for sure. I think that what you asked makes a ton of sense, right? If you're 20 years old, the big risks are the risks that you take, right? Alcohol, vaping, texting and driving. You talk about Molly or any other sort of crazy thing that you're going to do. There are risks there that you take in your 20s. And the goal is to mitigate those risks, because those lead to big mortality. When you're in your 30s, you have to really begin to set your base for hormone health, for muscle health, and for bone health. I'm telling you this in the 30s because in your 40s, you will start to decline. So you need to really build in your 30s. The problem is most people are not building in their 30s. They've started their families, they've sacrificed their health for their children or for their career, or for some combination of both. You can only serve one master, right? Social, sleep, physical activity, and profession. Choose two. You can never choose three. And that's the problem in your 30s. And so you have to choose two that matter most to you. And then I would say, in your 40s, what you really need to focus on are the big things that take you out, right? Cancers, heart disease, and strokes. And just because you're in your 40s doesn't mean you need to start taking risk again, like your 20s, to feel joie de vivre. And so, like for people, I say stay off of ladders, right? Like it's good advice. Like don't get in an accident because if you fall off a ladder, you're not going to heal as well in your 40s. Right. So you need to build the base of preventative care in your 40s. In your 50s, now you really have to double down on muscle building. Okay. You have to double down on muscle building and functional movement because if you're not doing that, you're going to suffer in your 60s, 70s, and 80s if you live that long. So, yes, I would say there are definitely decade strategies where we pan things out. And that's from traditional anticipatory guidance. But I think if you start in your 20s and 30s on focusing on mitochondrial health, diet, and risk reduction, you're in a way better spot when you get to your 40s and 50s.
So true. And how would you say that women have special or different needs? Obviously, I think hormones is one of the huge ones, but.
They're really two different species, right? I'm sorry. Genetically, there are massive differences. Hormonally, there are massive differences. And so there are different things required. One of the things that I think about a lot in women is their higher incidence of autoimmune disease. And so that means that their immune system is dysregulated, which means their thymus and their germinal centers are dysregulated at a much higher fashion than men are. So you have to make sure that their gut is right and that their thymus is right. And I'll keep beating this up, right? And how do you do that? You make sure that your gut microbiome is good. You make sure that your thymus is good. Why? Because those things talk to your mitochondria. Those things talk to your ability to make hormones properly. And so in women, men are pretty simple for a lot of things. They're also complicated for a lot of things. But in women, there's a constant state of change in their body. Those are things that just don't happen as much in men. And so, because of that, you have to be mindful of their changes and their cycles. If you aren't, then you end up trying to paintbrush longevity in everyone the same way, and that never works well.
It's very different in every phase of a woman's life, whether it's like she's just getting stable on her periods in her 20s or like wanting to get pregnant and then reproductive era and then perimenopause, menopause itself.
Well, not even that, just also somatopause, right? The growth hormone changes between when men and women are drastic. And women are especially vulnerable when their IGF-1 drops. So yeah, you have to pay attention to that.
Is growth hormone something you're routinely also supplementing with
Oh, well, yeah,
hormone and resmetirom?
I wrote an article about this a while ago, the great anti-aging curse, right? So we used to think growth hormone was one of these fantastic things that worked well for us. The problem is more and more, there's nothing new under the sun, right, Dr. K? Like, really. And so we're complaining about people selling Retta out of medi spas. But before that, they were selling growth hormone, right? And so I think about teams like Cenogenics that was trying to put a wrapper around it. But there were a lot of people who were just wildly administering growth hormone, resulting in not cancer, right? People were worried it's a bunch of cancer. No, diabetes. There were people that were getting diabetes from growth hormone, which is a common happenstance with it. If you're not properly measuring the IGF-1s, then you have no clue whether some of these growth hormone secretagogues or growth hormone itself are working well. And so I happen to like using these different growth hormone releasing hormone peptides, especially FDA approved ones. I was just talking in New York City about tesamorelin, which is an FDA approved growth hormone called Egrifta. And I find that if I can use an FDA approved peptide, I prefer to use that first because of the risk reward strategy of just about anything that you have. So yeah, I like that. I've had people use other growth hormone releasing hormones like Sermorelin or Ipamorelin, Ipamorelin, whatever you want to call it, and with CJC. So I myself tend to try and use FDA approved first, but the other ones work and I've seen them work. It's just not, as I said, pharma is really good at making powerful things. And so if you're looking for power versus nuance, then if you can use an FDA approved one, it's better for your license, it's better for your medical malpractice, and ultimately in the end you want to do what's right for the patient.
I totally agree. Another super powerful intervention that we've had that's revolutionized medicine these last few years is the GLP-1s. And can you talk a little bit about the effect of GLPs on full body regenerative health and how they might reverse some of our hallmarks of aging or our DNA methylation clocks.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you right now. I wrote a book about GLP-1s called Weight Loss Secrets, right? Everyone wrote a weight loss secret book. And it's like your ultimate guide to GLP-1 medications. And I wrote that a couple of years ago. I'm actually working on an update for that because the data that we have now on GLP-1s to help reduce incidence of cancer, separate of obesity, the data on reducing what we call chondrocyte senescence and osteoarthritis symptoms, separate of losing weight and obesity, are legion. They're very strong. And in addition to that, we're starting to shift our understanding of GLP-1s that were initially right diabetes meds. And I was using them off-label back in 2012 or 13 for weight loss because we had so many limited options that didn't have side effects for weight loss. And so what I was doing that before they became obesity medicines. Well, now I get to say, well, I was using GLP-1s for longevity and for mitochondria and for neuroinflammation. And so the answer is this set of molecules is very powerful. Our body makes GLP-1, but never in the concentration that we're using for these medicines. So, like a good example, like Byetta, which was one of the originals, that would have maybe a 10x concentration of GLP-1 that we'd normally have in our body. But semaglutide, that's like a hundredfold, right? And so we don't know long term what being on a hundredfold of GLP-1 is going to do for you. The jury's still out. But what we do know is that the evidence is getting really interesting about using GLP-1s in longevity, predominantly for musculoskeletal health. Now, in your field, I imagine there's a lot of challenges that with Ozempic face, right? I see people where that's a big challenge. You lose what, 7 to 10% of the fat in your face, and it's like you've lost 25%. You like age 20 years. And so is that good for longevity? Is that bad for longevity? The jury is still out, right? But we know that GLP-1s reduce inflammation, they reduce insulin resistance, they reduce fatty liver, and they may help with neurodegenerative disease. And so all of those things as a general rule are good for longevity.
It's true. It's definitely not amazing for the face, but we have regenerative treatments now that I'm doing, and I'm helping to pioneer some of that, where we're using collagen biostimulators preventatively and about every 10 pounds of weight loss to help, improve the skin quality, because the dermal white fat layer goes with Ozempic treatments, and every single fibroblast has GLP-1 sensitivities. And you really change the skin, starts to look aged just because the connection between dermis and epidermis really starts to suffer, and the vascular flow suffers. And it you're absolutely right. Is that good for longevity when you start to look older and you want to withdraw from all your social events? It's not. You have to.
Right. And that's the problem I see. And in the end, I think that's related to mitochondria. You see, the fibroblasts need active mitochondria and they need mitochondrial biogenesis. And if your GLP-1s are not the best for mitochondrial biogenesis, what is? Urolithin A, hyperbaric oxygen, like we just talked about. And there's some people who believe, and there's some small evidence on it, that near infrared therapy is really essential for mitochondrial biogenesis and effectiveness to reduce oxidative stress. So this is where I think the two intersect, right? The GLP-1 story and the mitochondrial health story. And I think going into a GLP-1, if your mitochondria are not optimized, I think you're going to find they have more face problems and they're going to have more fibroblast problems.
And hair loss, the
Yeah,
hair
oh, for
fall.
sure, right? That's one of my like hallmarks. Like if you're on a GLP-1, you start to lose hair. Boom. I'm on the fact that your mitochondrial scalp is bad, right? I'm on that your vascular supply is poor because you're not getting enough nutrients there, right? Your vascular reserve there is toast. And so you and that's why I think And that's why I like things like high concentration PRP, not just PRP, but like high concentration and not unless your mitochondria are optimized to begin with. We know in orthobiologics that if you have something like long COVID and you take those mitochondria from the platelets and concentrate them, it creates bone cysts and creates cartilage senescence, which is the exact opposite of what you want with PRP. So, yeah, you have to have optimized mitochondria before you concentrate and deliver them into the scalp, right?
Is there a way to assess that? Mitochondrial, I know there's some preliminary tests that kind of look at mitochondrial health. Do you know anything about those? Are you using them in your practice? Of course you do. Of
Counselor, you're
course
leading the
you
witness.
do.
So, in a nutshell, here's my take. Mitochondria can be assessed based on how they look. Those are like mitochondrial biopsies. They're pretty painful, but they're helpful. Then, based on their function, and these are things like a seahorse assay or something we call a mito swab, which looks at that efficiency of that daisy chain I was telling you about, right, where the electron transport chain kind of moves electrons. And then there are what we call mitochondrial biomarkers. These are things that mitochondria produce when they're in pain, right? They cry out, they go, "Ah, I'm hurting." And it's true. And you can hear them. You just listen real close. You can hear the mitochondria. No, but what I like is something called GDF15, growth differentiating factor 15, as a general rule for mitochondria are suffering. And so if they're suffering, then you have to work on them. Another one is called FGF21, which we also use. And then you have to look at the downstream. That's mitochondrial function. As I said, electron transport chain is just how it's flowing. There's no great assay for your ATP, but there are for how you're metabolizing your proteins, how you're metabolizing your carbohydrates, how you're metabolizing your fats. Those are things like your insulin levels. Those are things like an acyl-carnitine profile to look at how you're metabolizing fats, and plasma amino acids to look at how you're metabolizing amino acids and any backups in that chain. All of that play a role in mitochondrial effectiveness. And so the short answer is yes, there's a ton to do. But your bigger question is how many people are doing it? And I would say less than 1% of physicians in the United States are using these tools.
Way less than 1%. I think that's not yet out there commercially easily available, but it's coming.
No, it's a challenge. Some of it is actually covered by insurance. If you've identified mitochondrial dysfunction in a patient from their regular general labs, and that can be easy. That's like a lactate pyruvate ratio, or that's looking at a CRP and an insulin. Insulin resistance is really a mitochondrial problem. So all of these metabolism problems, you can link back to mitochondrial dysfunction.
And metabolomics, are you doing some metabolomic testing? What companies do you like for that?
It's very interesting. In January, I talked at our Longevity Docs Mastermind, where I talked about the omics and all the different things we can test for and what's ready for prime time and what's not. For me, as a geneticist, right, I served as a clinical geneticist fellow up at Yale, and also did metabolic training down at Mount Sinai. For me, a metabolomic panel is easy to interpret. For most people, it's kind of challenging. You have to understand urea cycles, you have to understand protein breakdown and those sorts of things. So when people give you this fancy scale of metabolomics, you have to come with a little caution and you have to be prepared to interpret it. I do like looking at these panels through insurance-based panels first. So like Mayo has a great metabolomic panel. LabCorp has a good plasma amino acid panel. You can get urine organic acids from, like, back in the days, like Great Smokies, or Vibrant Lab has some of these tests as well. But I always try and tell people, if you can get insurance to cover these tests first, you pay for insurance, so you should try that way. The problem with that is that it doesn't come with a user manual. You actually have to have the training. And so again, I like using tools if you're not versed in metabolomics. And open evidence is helpful at giving you a harness there, right? Doximity has an AI that's helpful as a harness for doctors. So I would say those things are good, not great. and you can't take them as 100%. It's kind of like Wikipedia, right? Wikipedia should never be your final source, but it's a good first source, a leaping off point, if you will.
I think that's very accurate. Are you doing anything for your own mitochondria? Like, can you share
Oh,
with us
yeah.
your supplement stack of what you're taking? And then I want to get your thoughts on rapamycin.
Okay, cool. So I am a mitochondriac. That means that my world kind of revolves around mitochondria because our energy, our life force, our chi, our prana, like what, well, you say a bunch of different terms for whatever it is. Our energy flow comes from our mitochondria. And so if mama mitochondria is happy, we're all happy. But if mama mitochondria is not, no one in the house is. So my stack is simple. I focus on circadian rhythm, red light. I'm gonna show you something kind of cool here, right? So it's now in the afternoon, but in the morning, if I'm on the computer, I've got red light and near infrared light. So that's number one. If I'm on a screen, I'm offsetting the blue light in the morning. In the middle of the day, I'm getting blue light. I'm getting a good UV spectrum. I'm actually going out in sun. Most people don't realize the window panes block some of the good sun. And also, it's very important, we don't want solar damage, but we want resilient skin that can handle and accept the sun that comes in aliquots that are appropriate. So in the middle of the day, I'm going to get about 10 minutes of sun. At the end of the day, I'm going to wind down and avoid LEDs to help my mitochondria. That's my circadian strategy. Number two is my supplement strategy. I am all about making more mitochondria in an effective way and getting rid of dysfunctional mitochondria. So those would be the terms called mitochondrial biogenesis and mitochondrial autophagy, which is shortened to mitophagy. I like to think about growing new mitochondria and get rid of the bad ones, mitophagy. So with mitochondrial biogenesis, that's high intensity interval training. I don't do that because I don't want to hurt my joints, but it's also zone two training. So I take walks uphill. I also will use urolithin A as a supplement. So urolithin A has been shown to improve mitochondrial biogenesis and mitophagy. Fasting, intermittent fasting improves mitophagy. Also, and that's part of my stack. Also, I do like hyperbaric oxygen when used properly. And it takes a it's a big inter it's a big investment. And having a chamber in your office makes it a lot easier. In addition to the supplement and the behavioral stuff, right? I like to think about optimizing my mitochondria by optimizing my gut. And I do that through fermented vegetables, inulin, and fiber predominantly.
I think that's a great stack. Any senolytics that you're taking?
Ah, so right. So I do take rapamycin. I
Yeah,
take rap.
you do.
Yeah, I
That's
do. I take
cool.
rapamycin.
What dose and how often?
Right, there we go. What I'm now at 8 milligrams. I've varied between 10, 8, and 6 relative to aphthous ulcers because I'm one of the guys that gets aphthous ulcers from rapamycin. I will do that in pulses. So I'll run that for 3 months and stop, run that for 3 months and then stop. I track my triglycerides with that because that's important. And I track my blood counts, which have never really been a major issue with this. And in fact, after COVID, my CD4 and CD8 sort of flipped. And rapamycin, when I went back on rapamycin, it turned them back to normal. Whether that was the rapamycin or not, it certainly was an interesting time period to have that happen. So I do rapamycin and then I will do dasatinib pulses. So at least once a year, I'll take dasatinib 100 milligrams for 3 days, 3 days only, and with 1,000 of quercetin, a DNQ. So I'll do that or I'll fast, which is a great senolytic.
Like a 3-day water fest.
I will do a 3-day water fast. I will also do a 3-day coffee fast. So I will take coffee
Oh,
with no food,
that's gonna
just
be
black
fun.
coffee. Yeah, that's it for me. That's hunger, but it's also focus. So that's what
Yeah.
it helps.
Very interesting. Okay. Are there other things on your stack we're not saying that are
No,
doesn't?
I'm pretty lean, right? In terms of optimizing mitochondria, I make sure diet-wise I have enough carnitine. I make sure also my gut is okay with the carnitine I take from my diet, from the choline that I take from my diet. I eat meat and eggs, and my TMAO is low. So that's how I know I'm doing well with my gut microbiome with those foods.
Amazing. Well, that seems like straightforward and like under 10 pills, like just one
Yeah,
egg.
no, I'm not Brian Johnson.
No vampire blood for you.
No. Everyone's got their own risk benefit tolerance, and that's important too.
And how long have you been on rapamycin?
Oh, I started rapamycin years ago, well north of a decade ago.
Oh, dang.
And this started actually with a patient who came to me in 2010 or 2011, asking me to write rapamycin for him that long ago. And so, what is that, 15 years ago? So yeah, that led me down really investigating rapamycin as a tool.
Very
Yeah,
interesting.
it's a pulsed tool that's fasting. It's like a fasting mimetic.
Yeah.
That it really, you can't take it all the time. There is some evidence that it doesn't help you with muscle gains with strength training, and there's some evidence that it does. So it pick your poison, but monitoring for the risk is important when you're on rapamycin.
Have you tested any of your aging clocks to see if
Oh
perhaps it's
yes.
helping?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the tough part is all of the tools. It's so funny. Longevity is awesome, but all of the tools came out after I had already started, right? So most of the tools are 3 or 4 years old at most now to be able to test all the hallmarks of aging. We've never had that before. It's pretty remarkable. So there is a little bias there. My Dunedin is 0.75, but I'll tell you this right now. Full stop. Control your mitochondria, take care of your gut health, take care of your thymus. That's how my stack is really built.
What do you take for your thymus?
Well,
Thymus and
first and
alpha
foremost
one.
is red light. Red
Yeah.
light on
Oh yeah,
thymus.
red light here. I've been doing that. That's
That's
nice.
number one.
Good for neck skin too.
Yeah, for sure. It's a double. I'm a big fan of like double or triple benefits from things, right? Because we're so busy, you have to like maximize what you do. So I ground, right? So I ground. When I do morning sun and evening sun, I'm grounding. I am also using that red light on the thymus and on the skin of my neck. I don't know. I'm a little chubby now, so it's tough to tell whether this is young, healthy skin or not.
You look youthful. You look very youthful.
Not bad. And I think the red light has played a big role in that, believe it or not. I think red
Yeah.
light has played a big role. I still have wrinkles, but that's because I talk with my face and my hands. I think that's a big part of
That's easy to fix, but we also actually have brand new topical rapamycin. It's called ReQ, which is
So
M4.
I use that in my patients. I've used it for
Good.
patients with melasma. I've used it for patients with inflammatory stuff. It works.
It works great. And our the
Yeah.
ReQ is specifically mTOR1. It's a rapalog that drives the mTOR1 pathway, whereas I think compounded rapamycin may
Yeah,
not.
you don't get that. Yeah, I think you're probably right about
Yeah, so that's very cool. You're very on top of everything. So
that.
what are emerging trends you have your eyes on? And we'll just finish with that.
Oh, I think the future of longevity medicine and the future of aesthetic medicine is going to revolve around cellular programs, right? The old model was fixing wrinkles. Now we're going to prevent wrinkles in the first place. And I think we can do that through mitochondrial improvement. I didn't talk about exercise. That matters too, right? I think mitochondrial improvement, I think cellular programming is going to change radically. And I think transcriptomics is this last paper that just came out a couple days ago that I'm chewing through. In January, I said transcriptomics wasn't ready for prime time. My opinion of that is definitely changing. So I think cellular programming modifying it and identifying the issues with transcriptomics are going to be one of the leading future modalities for aesthetic medicine, for longevity medicine, and for medicine as a whole. There's no doubt.
I think that's so interesting that I'm reading through that paper also. And these
Oh my
papers,
God. This
a lot of
paper
work.
is insane. The amount of work that was done from
Yeah.
their model, it was, I like to think of it like a lawyer preparing a law case, right? They've thought about every argument where they're going to be countered in their presupposition, and they defeated the argument. And so it is really it is a hallmark paper, right? Tishkovsky, it and Gladyshev is the senior author. This paper is going to transform what we call our hallmarks of mammalian aging and mortality by focusing on transcriptomics. It's unbelievable.
So exciting. It's exciting times for us in aesthetics and in longevity medicine and regeneration.
Yeah.
And I hope we get to stay in touch. You're so brilliant. And I think you have like so much, really focused knowledge, which it's important to have someone who can weed through all the noise and just get down to what's really essential core. And as you said, that's the cellular level. That's the function of the mitochondria.
Yep, that's the future. Yeah, I want to thank you again for having me on. Dr. K, you're awesome. This was great.
Oh, yeah, this was terrific. Where can people find you, Dr. Murphy?
The easiest way to find me is on my Substack, which is drmurphy.substack.com. Otherwise, if you want to be impatient, you go to conciergemedical.ai, conciergemedical.ai, and that's where they can find us on the website and see what we're all about.
That's amazing. Do you have social handles? Are you on social media?
Yes, I'm an obesity medicine doctor, right? Way back when. So my Twitter is Take Weight Off MD. I could ramble on the rest of them, but if you go to the either near those three websites, you'll find all the rest.
That's perfect. Well, that's it for now, guys. Don't forget to find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, Drkay, doing amazing things with people's faces. And so much is coming in regenerative medicine and what we're doing for skin and how it can heal itself. Senescence of the skin. As you said, it's not just lines and wrinkles. These are areas of senescence and they're external markers of what's going on internally. So I'm all about it. I'm here for the longevity space. That's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful.